members on the virtual, to welcome the public protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, the legal team of the public protector, led by advocates Mbofu and Tshabalala. I welcome the evidence leaders, Advocate Bauer and Advocate Mayosi, members of the media joining us, the entire support staff of the inquiry, and last but most importantly, those who watch us, those who brought us to be here as members of parliament, members of the public who have had a keen interest from day one, participating in the YouTube parliamentary streaming, as well as 408. We welcome you. As you follow us, we also follow the comments you're making about the process. You're welcome. Thank you very much. I'm now going to, again, indicate the timelines for the day, that immediately after I would have spoken, I'm going to allow Advocate Bauer and Ms. Fatima Ibrahim to introduce the witness, and we'll resume with the leading of evidence by Advocate Bauer and Advocate Mayosi. That will start immediately after this up until 12. And from 12, we will proceed to cross-examination by the legal team of the public protector up until 3. And thereafter, members will interact with the witness. Thank you very much. Advocate Bauer.
Good.
Advocate Bauer. Okay, just before Honorable Mahlaule and Honorable Nkosi.
Thank you very much, Chair, and greetings to everyone. I just want to raise one issue. It may not look important, but it's an issue that shouldn't be a punishment to be physical and not virtually. It's very cold here. Very, very cold, Chair, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mahlaule. And you don't seem to be alone. There are people who have just become happy after you raised that. So you are a good substitute. can you attend to that? Same thing we asked yesterday, that we will tell them when we need fresh air. So just tell them to switch it off. Thank you. Honorable Nkosi.
No, Chair, thank you very much. Chair, I just want to make two requests with regards to yesterday's witness, Mr. Mahlangu. Mr. Mahlangu indicates that in his tenure, he achieved clean audits in the PPSA. My calculation is that he was there for less than 2 years. He joined in the conclusion of one financial year, I think it was 17-18, and he would have been responsible for his own budget, which would have started in June. That would have been 18-19. No, he was implementing 18-19. He would have started his budget for 19-20 in June or September, around that. So He definitely is not responsible for 18, for 17, 18. So I need records. I'm requesting records for myself, just to clarify myself, for which particular year a clean audit. Secondly, I would like to have a record of the, I'm requesting the secretariat to provide us with a record of the hearing in his previous employment, so that we I am able to just trace how he was, how the DC arrived at the decision to find him guilty. So those are my two requests, Chair.
Thank you. Even though long, but it's just two requests. I think we've noted those requests. About the annual report in relation to issues of clean audit and a hearing records of the previous employment. Is that what you?
From Land Affairs.
Okay. That's fine. The requests are noted and we'll follow that.
Chairperson?
I saw I'm not seeing your hand. Do you want to speak, Advocate?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm sorry, Chairperson. I should have raised my hand. Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. Just on those issues very quickly, just wanted to advise the honorable member that the financial year of the public protector does not start in June, starts in April, but also to check what is the relevance of some hearing at Land Affairs. Yeah. But that's for you. The second question will be on your shoulders, Chair, but just the first one is just for information.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. I normally, I get your point. This would not be the first request. Members would have before requested different forms of information. And when they do that, I stand back as a chair from questioning their relevance. I provide. But if it has to come to the inquiry, that's when I switch on the relevance. But giving them information, I don't get into that space. But I'm watching in terms of when we in the inquiry, whether any of those issues are going to be relevant to the motion. So rest assured.
That's fine.
We attend to those issues.
Thank you.
Advocate Bawa?
Chair, Advocate Mayosi is going to be dealing with this morning's witness.
That's fine. Thank you. Ms. Fatima Ibrahim?
Thank you very much and good morning, Chair and members. Chair, I just wanted to mention that the annual reports are available in bundle F that the members have. It's number 1 to 6 of that bundle, if any of the members would want to go and read those annual reports. Is the witness on the platform? If you could please switch on your camera.
Chair, the name of the next witness is Mr. Futana Simon Debele.
Futana Simon Debele is our witness today. Mr. Debele, can we hear your voice? Are you there?
Morning, honorable members. I'm here.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Mr. Tabele, can I please ask that you state your full name for the record?
Thank you, honorable member, through you, Chair. My name is Futana Simon Tabele.
Mr. Tabele, you have been invited subject to the provisions of Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act 2004 to appear before this committee as a witness and to answer questions in respect of the committee's inquiry into the removal of the public protector, Advocate Mkwebane. Please be informed that by law, you're required to answer fully and satisfactorily all questions lawfully put to you or to produce any documents that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of this inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that the evidence you give under oath or affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside of Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers Act, a person who willfully furnishes a house or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading, commits an offence and is liable to a fine or a period of imprisonment not exceeding 2 years. Mr. Tebela, I'm now going to ask you to please take an oath or to affirm that the evidence you're about to give is truthful. Which do you prefer, the oath or affirmation?
I'll take an oath.
May I please ask that you raise your right hand and repeat after me? I swear that the evidence I shall give.
I swear that the evidence I shall give.
Shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Shall be the truth and the whole truth, but nothing but the truth.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you, sir. Chair, the witness is now duly sworn in.
Thank you, Ms. Ibrahim, and thank you to you, Mr. Debele, and welcome to the inquiry. The inquiry is now in session. Advocate Mayosi.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Mr. Debele.
Good morning, Advocate Mayosi.
And good morning, honorable members. Mr. Debele, you made a statement for these proceedings, correct?
Yes, Advocate Mayosi and honorable members.
I'm going to take you through the statement that you made. We won't deal with the statement line by line or paragraph by paragraph, but we'll just deal with some of the salient features of that statement. Okay.
Thank you.
Can I ask you to put it up? It's in bundle D and it's item 9. So, paragraph 1, and just keep going down. So, Mr. Debele, you're currently employed at the PPSA as Senior Manager CEO Support in the Office of the Chief Executive Officer, correct?
Correct.
Can you explain to the committee what your job entails and who you report to?
Thank you, Advocate Mayosi, honorable members. I currently report to the Chief Executive Officer in the Office of the Public Protector, that is Ms. Thandi Spanyoni. And my role in the office is to assist the CEO in the management of the institution. The CEO as the accounting officer. I conduct a quality assurance of documents that gets into the CEO's office. And those documents, ultimately, most of them will go to the private office, which is the Office of the Public Protector. I assist the Office of the CEO in monitoring the performance of the institution. In as far as the annual performance plan is concerned. And I act as the secretariat of the meetings that are organized by the Office of the CEO, which is EXCO and MANCO. And I ensure that the resolutions taken in those meetings are followed up and they are implemented. And I also facilitate the organization of those meetings within the office. I manage the budget in the office of the CEO together with its expenditure assisted by my finance. That is in brief the role of my position in the CEO's office.
You're a lawyer by professional qualification, right?
Yes.
You say in your statement you've never practiced as an attorney, but that you were a prosecutor for a brief period in the early days, correct?
Correct.
Can you tell the committee a little bit more about your work experience before you joined the PPSA?
Thanks, Advocate Majosi, through your chair and members. I started my career, as I indicated, that was for a short brief as a prosecutor. And after that, I joined the Department of Finance in a division that was called then Inland Revenue. Inland Revenue is what is now called SARS. That was before it became SARS. So I was dealing with special cases on the income tax court roll. We were preparing cases for the receiver of revenue that we're going to seek. And we were also dealing with administration of estates, because during that time, the South African Revenue Services now had a stake in terms of administration of estates. So we would calculate what was owed and submit it to the executor of the estate. And when the organization was formed in 1996, I was requested by the then minister, Minister Alec Ewen, if I remember well, to remain in the Department of Finance. And a unit was established called Tax Policy Unit. And that is where I was. And within National Treasury, because I joined before National Treasury was formed in 1999, then within National Treasury, I performed functions of tax policy, doing a research and advisory on policy, participating in the budget and the tax proposals. Then I was seconded to a unit called Public-Private Partnership Unit when it started around 2004. My role there was to check how public-private partnership transactions will be taxed. And from there, then I was assisting National Treasury in entity oversight, where most of the entities that were established needed treasury. So I served in the advisory committee of those entity oversights. Then I was in treasury for a period of about 15 years. Then I moved to Limpopo Treasury. That is where I was based, I think around 2007, as a chief director. Then I went to the Department of Transport when the province was put under administration to assist with the administration in that department. And that is where I left to join the public protector in 2017. Thank you, honorable members.
So you joined the Office of the Public Protector in June 2017, correct?
Correct.
And the position you occupied then was senior manager executive support in the private office. Is that right?
Correct.
And you reported to the chief of staff who was also in the private office. Is that right?
Correct.
So can you explain for us, Mr. Tebele, when you say private office, what do you mean? Who does the private office consist of?
Thank you, Advocate Majosi, through your chairperson. The private office within the Public Protector South Africa refers to the office where the executive authority sits. That is the Public Protector and the Deputy Public Protector. And it refers to the staff that is responsible to support that office. So we have an office of the private office, which is almost distinct from the office of the accounting officer. All the staff supporting the Public Protector and the Deputy Public Protector, they are part of private office. I found the name there. Then I got to know it as such. Thank you.
So you said the DPP forms part of the private office?
Yes, the executive authority, because in terms of our understanding, both the Public Protector and the Deputy Public Protector, they are the executive authority. So they both form part of the private office.
So what support did you give the DPP, one? And secondly, what role did the DPP play in the organization?
In terms of the structure that I found there, I mostly worked with the Public Protector. The Deputy Public Protector had support staff in terms of the investigations that were assigned to him. Because in terms of my understanding of how the office worked, the Public Protector would delegate certain responsibilities to the Deputy Public Protector. And the Deputy Public Protector, with the staff that was assisting him, which was mainly in investigation, then they will deal with that. My role was as an entry point into both offices. When submissions are made to both the Public Protector and the Deputy Public Protector, coming from the investigation team, we will be the first to receive such information. And after we have dealt with the information, then if it belongs to the Deputy Public Protector, we will send it through to the Deputy Public Protector. And if it belongs to the Public Protector, we will reroute it that way. So the responsibilities of the Deputy Public Protector were mostly assigned through the Public Protector with the delegations.
So you say in your statement, in October 2018, you were requested to act in the position of Executive Manager, Corporate Services, right?
Correct.
And as Executive Manager, Corporate Services, you managed various divisions, including legal services, HR, ICT, and security management, correct?
Correct.
Now, Mr. Baldwin Neshunzi was the senior manager responsible for security from April 2017 until July 2019. Is that right?
Correct, although I may not get the dates correct.
According to him, and he will testify of this to this committee, he was moved from the position of senior manager responsible for security with effect from 1 August 2019. And he was moved into the position of senior manager in another branch, customer service management. Do you recall that?
Yes, I recall that.
So he says that he will say when he testifies that he didn't apply for this position and he did not at that stage have any experience in the matters that the customer service management branch dealt with. Can you explain to the committee why Mr. Neshunzi was moved from security to customer services?
Thanks, through you, Chair. What I will say is what I know, not that I actively participated in it. When Mr. Neshunzi came back from, I will call it from the suspension, there was a report which I did not have preview to. And apparently in that report, there was a recommendation that he be moved. I haven't seen the report, but I was approached by the former CEO, Mr. Mahlangu. He said to me, because of the role that Mr. Neshunzi is playing in security, and the current cloud that is there in terms of leaking of information, he deemed it best that he be moved out of that portfolio so that somebody maybe can come and manage that portfolio, because he's saying the information security that he is responsible for, he could not handle it the way that it needed to be handled. And there were areas in which they needed to check which place, which area was the best suited to. And I remember when he came back, I also indicated to him that the leadership is of the view that you be moved from the office of the security to another area. And at that time, there was an opening in the unit called CSM, and Mr. Neshunzi was moved to CSM to be responsible, I think, for intake and assessment. That is how far I understand the situation of Mr. Neshunzi. Indeed, yes, he did not apply. For operational reasons, he was moved to that area. That is what I got, and that is how Mr. Mahlangu, our former CEO, consulted me on, because he requested me to consult Mr. Neshunzi with that offer, which I did.
So the report that you're referring to and which you say you were not privy to, is that the Diallo Mogashwa report?
Yes, there was an investigation in terms of the leaking of information within the institution. And that company was responsible to do the investigation. The reason why I'm saying I was not privy to the report is because during their investigation, they took certain laptops which they needed to check for whatever information they needed to check. And my laptop was also amongst those that were taken. So I requested that I don't participate in the work that they do due to the fact that I could have been also the one that is being investigated because my laptop was also taken. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Tibelo, when the evidence leaders first met with you, we explained to you that we were tasked with leading evidence in this inquiry as a result of a motion in which allegations are made against the PP. And we also explained to you that those allegations of incompetence and misconduct arise from the Saab report and the Freda matter. Do you recall our discussion in that first meeting?
Yes, I recall the discussion.
Yeah. We then also told you that the motion also included an allegation about the PP having intimidated, harassed, and victimized staff, or having failed to protect staff when they were victimized, harassed, and intimidated by Mr. Vuse Mahlangu. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember.
So, and then we asked you to share whatever information you had in relation to those aspects, whatever direct knowledge you had in relation to those aspects. Now, let's start first with the CIX report, because I think it's easier to dispense with in your case. Given that you started at the PPSA on the 1st of June, 2017, and that the final CIX report was issued later that same month, were you involved at all in this investigation and report?
Thank you, Advocate and the honorable members. When I joined the institution, the investigation, I would think that it was at the end, because my first interaction with knowing about the CX was in a meeting, because as I was part of the private office, I was in a meeting where the investigators were briefing the PP in terms of the report. My role in the report, because I was not there when the investigation was done, was mainly to deal with the editorial part of the report leading towards the report being issued. But I've never dealt with really the investigation of that report, except the editorial aspect of the report.
Thank you. Now, turning to your affidavit, and I'll deal with the themes that you discuss in your affidavit, starting with the description of task team, which you do from paragraphs 6 to 8. You describe a structure called the task team, which used to hold meetings every Friday and chaired by the PP initially. And you say that the main purpose of that structure was to check on progress in producing reports and issuing notices. So my question to you, just for our benefit, was the substance of investigations also discussed at task team meetings, or was it limited just to monitoring timelines and the progress of meeting those timelines?
Thank you, Advocate and honorable members. When I joined the private office, the first meeting, besides the introductory meeting which I had with the public protector and the chief of staff, the first meeting was with a team called Quality Assurance, which was based in private office, which was assisting the public protector in the reports. So Quality Assurance, they were part of what we called a task team. A task team was a committee that was sitting every Friday. And the committee was chaired by the public protector. And what was appearing on the task team agenda was mainly reports or investigations that have reached Section 7-9 stage, or investigations that have already reached report writing stage. Those type of investigations, they will come and serve in the task team for the quality assurance team to go through them and to advise the public protector. And during those meetings, the quality assurance team would also deal with the content of the Section 7-9s and the content of the reports during those meetings. And they will engage the investigators respectively through the leadership of the public protector who was chairing those meetings. Yes, contents during those meetings would also be dealt with, because the quality assurance team would go into each and every paragraph, read the whole section 7-9 or the report, and give their views and their inputs. And if the report needed to go back for correction, it will go back for correction. Thanks, Chair.
So you say you were involved in this quality assurance process for task team. My question is, before performing the QA function for task team, what was your previous experience in quality assurance?
In my career, I've dealt with a lot of documentations in terms of quality assurance. To be specific, in National Treasury, I was also the co-author of that Chapter 4, which used to be called Chapter 4 of the Budget Review, where we were doing tax proposals. Most of the team members within the tax policy unit had their own way of drafting into that. And I used to serve in National Treasury in terms of quality assuring those budget documents before they were submitted. And even previously in my working career, I have been going through different documentation in terms of quality assurance. The assurance in the public protector, it was a different one in the sense that they had a specific template that they were following in terms of how they were doing and writing their report writing. So that is why my initial involvement was mostly on the editorial part and not much to do with the content. And to the extent that I will find something amiss in the content, then I will also engage the investigators in terms of the content. But I have done a lot of quality assurance documentation in my career, in my previous lives. Thanks.
All right. We've already covered your previous positions that you occupied in the office. Move along. If we can go to the next section of your affidavit, yes, that deals with the Ms. Mulelekwa and Advocate Matlawe issue. You describe tensions that arose in the private office between Advocate Matlawe and Ms. Mulelekwa, who was then the acting chief of staff, in paragraph 11. This is when you also were still in the private office, right?
Correct.
Now, can you very, very briefly, just for the benefit of the committee, tell us what the in greater detail what the cause of the tension between them was?
Thanks, Advocate and the honorable members. This will be my observation as I was part of the team. The quality assurance team, which was based in the public protector's office, by virtue of the chief of staff being the most senior person in that office, they were reporting through the chief of staff to the public protector. The public protector had a direct link with the quality assurance team, but in terms of managing their documents and information that is flowing, they were submitted through the office of the chief of staff and myself. And in doing our work, we will look at the documents and where we have things to question, then we will question the information. So when Ms. Mulelekwa was trying to question certain information in terms of how she understood certain things, then there was this, I would call it this office acrimony of saying that this person is not a lawyer. Why will this person look at our work? And I think it went to the extent where they started raising the issue of her not having the legal qualification and not fit to quality assure their reports. And while that was not the first in terms of people not being happy, when the quality assurance team also was assisting the public protector, executive managers also, they started seeing themselves almost like reporting to juniors. That is how the whole thing planned out. And I, from my observation, that is where the disagreements started. And Mr. Matlawe was very much vocal about the dissatisfaction. And that is how I have seen it unfolding. Thanks.
So in paragraph 14 onwards, well, in paragraph 14, you describe the worsening of relationships when Mr. Matlawe didn't turn up on a weekend when he was required by the PP to attend and quality assure the CIX report. Can I just ask, was it expected that employees make themselves available for work on weekends?
Thanks, Advocate, and through you, Chair. Mostly, people are not expected to go to work over the weekend. But if a request is made and the people indicate their availability, that can be accommodated for operational reasons. I remember a public protector asking that because of time, the report needed to be finalized. And there was a request to the quality assurance team. I can't remember whether it was all of them, but Mr. Matlawe being the lead of the quality assurance team, we were requested to come. I think it was leading towards a holiday of June 16. I can't remember. We were requested to come on a day that was not a work day. And we agreed that we will come. And indeed, we came on that day. And Mr. Matlawe did not pitch on that day. But he was expected to come because he never indicated his commitment on that particular day. So to summarize it, it is not generally expected for people to work on weekends, but for operational reasons, people could be requested to work on weekends. And if they agree, it will happen. And I remember that under the circumstances, they agreed and other members pitched up, but he did not pitch up on that specific day.
Linked to this, possibly this requirement to work on weekends, which you say was not generally there unless agreed to by employees. Some witnesses will come and testify that the taking of leave was frowned upon in the organization, that leave was often canceled or refused. Can you comment to this?
Yeah, although I may not be specific advocate and through you, Chair, in terms of specific circumstances, but it is a general practice that leave, when you request it, the person who needs to approve your leave, not to look at the operational requirements, whether the operational requirements on that day that you want to take leave do allow. And in certain instances, the supervisor can say, because of what is facing us and the deadlines and all these other issues that might be prevailing under those circumstances, leave can be denied. I'm not sure if when leave is denied, the frowning upon of the leave, I really, that one, I can't comment on it, but I know that a supervisor can deny somebody leave due to operational reasons. That one can happen.
Right. So in paragraph 17, you talk about Ms. Mulelekwa then moving from the private office and back to her position of manager customer services. Why was she moved from the private office back to her original position?
Thanks, Advocate and Honorable Members. This incident happened quite a while ago. But what happened is the first move that happened is quality assurance was moved out of the public protector's office in terms of it now going back to the executive managers, because the public protector said everybody is responsible for quality assurance of their particular report. So the work of quality assurance is no longer going to reside in private office. So respective members of the quality assurance team were moved to different branches within PPSA in terms of investigations. And the lead, who was Mr. Matlawe, was also moved. If I remember well, he was moved to report to the acting COO during that time. That is where the work was placed. And Ms. Mulelekwa, due to certain circumstances that I really don't have much information on, except that there were media inquiries in the space and the media reports. And I would also recall in one of the meetings that the public protector was addressing parliament, certain members wanted to understand the role of Ms. Mulelekwa. I would think that that was the reason why the public protector felt that it will be proper for Ms. Mulelekwa to leave the office and the quality assurance team also to be moved elsewhere. And that is just my observation, but I was not part of how the real move happened, but I know she was moved and she moved back to, I think, an original position that she had before her acting. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Deber. You've already alluded to the leaking of information and the investigation that resulted from that leak. This is the investigation where Advocate Matlawe, Mr. Neshunzi, and Mr. Kekana were implicated. Is that correct, or investigated?
Thanks, Advocate, and through you, Chair, and Honorable Members. The investigation, from my understanding, where it started as the leaking of information. And the reason why maybe Mr. Neshunzi was singled out was because he was the one that was responsible to communicate with SSA, who were responsible to conduct a vetting on our staff. So that particular one, because I think it involved the outcome of the security clearance of the CEO, then the CEO felt that there is a risk in the organization. But when the investigation started, it did not pinpoint to Matlawe and Devoho, but the person who was the suspect in terms of leaking of the information, because the feeling was he was the custodian of that particular information and nobody else should have known about it, was Mr. Neshunzi. And it was after the investigations that I think the others were involved in the investigation, or Mr. Matlawe and Mr. Debo Gekan. It was as a result of the investigation itself, but I don't recall that when the investigation started, they were part of the people suspected to be having the information, maybe during the investigation.
Thanks, Mr. Deber. So in the next section of your affidavit, and we'll spend a bit more time on this section. This is section D, where you've titled it Reporting Investigations Backlog in the PP. And you describe the working environment in the office of the PP. You describe it in various ways throughout this section. So I'm just going to pick you on some of the paragraphs where you describe it and ask you to elaborate. Safe to say that I think it's appropriate to point out upfront here and just confirm that this is your evidence, that you yourself have never been intimidated, harassed, or victimized by the PP, correct?
That's correct.
And that you have never seen the PP intimidate, victimize, harass employees, nor have you seen the former CEO, Mr. Mahlangu, would do the same. That is your evidence. Is that right?
That's correct.
So just going back to the beginning of this section then, paragraph 21, where you describe the working environment as highly charged and demanding. Can you elaborate, please, on what you mean by that?
Thanks, Advocate, through you, Chair, and honorable members. I am not going to beat around the bush in terms of the demand in the office. And because I have seen it in many meetings that I attended, and I have seen people falling short of giving what is supposed to be given. The work in the public protector is yes, is demanding on its own. And I think what compounded the problem is a lot of cases that were within the team members that had aged, which means they would have passed their time in which they were expected to have finalized them. And the public protector wanted to deal with those cases, and they were named backlog cases. The backlog cases, in terms of my understanding, is those cases that would have, in terms of the timeline that they were supposed to have been investigated, they have passed their timeline. And the emphasis that the public protector always had during these meetings was put yourself into the shoes of the complainant and tell me if you submitted this complaint in the public protector and this particular complaint remains. Sorry about that. The emphasis from the public protector was that she needed really service delivery to be done and to be done promptly. And as such, she emphasized that people should follow the standard operating procedures in terms of dealing with investigations. And I would think that she was really not happy with the backlog that was sitting in the office and things not moving, let alone the fact that during the investigations, there are complainants which would directly talk to the public protector about their dissatisfaction. So in her trying to deal with the backlog that was there in the organization, to reduce it to the level where investigators can now deal with investigation at their own pace without anybody following them, she put up a lot of programs in trying to deal with that one. And that in itself put a lot of pressure on the investigators. And the public protector demanded investigators to give deadlines in terms of the work that they were doing. I would even remember her saying that, you guys, you are always saying that because I give you deadlines. This time, I don't want to give anybody deadline. I would want you guys to give me deadlines. But once you give me a deadline, you must adhere to that deadline. And most of the deadlines that would have been given could not be adhered to. And I would remember, because I was recording those deadlines, there will be matters where you find that a deadline was given in February, and maybe even up to today, for example, the deadline has not yet been met. So you can imagine on a meeting that is happening every Friday, where you need to be asked about the very same information, and you keep on shifting the goalpost. From my understanding and observing how the public protector worked, she did not take kindly the issue of deadlines not being met. And in an institution where you had more than 160 people investigating, you can imagine what how many deadlines will be there and how many of them will not be met. As such, the work itself demanded more, and the executive authority demanded outputs.
So you then say in paragraph 23 that the backlog clearing initiative then created quite a lot of pressure within the office, as you've just also described it. But you also say in paragraph 23 that before the appointment of the CEO, the executive managers responsible for investigations reported directly to the PP, and that might have exacerbated a highly pressurized atmosphere. So why did the fact that the EMs were reporting directly to the PP exacerbate the pressure?
Yeah, maybe this may not have been put correctly, but before the arrival of the chief operating officer, all the EMs were reporting directly to the public protector. And the way the structure was, the public protector could interact with investigators directly, even if she doesn't need to go through the executive, that executive manager. Because in the meetings that I attended that the public protector was chairing, EMs and their teams were attending those meetings. And in most cases, information will be demanded from an investigation member, and the EM will have to answer why in the word of the public protector. But guys, why should I go and deal with your juniors when you guys are there? Because you're not giving me any reason not to deal with your juniors. Now I have to deal with the juniors when you are currently there. So that is the environment that that existed. And I felt that because the juniors did not see themselves in a meeting, I think, with the public protector, during those interactions, I would feel that they were beginning to feel like they're being intimidated to be in that part of the meeting. But I think when time goes by, they got used to the situation where they were beginning to present to the public protector and also their EMs being available. So it was that type of a scenario where I believed that as a junior, once you start seeing yourself closer to the executive authority, you start to feel that you are much exposed, because you thought your senior should speak on your behalf. But the environment in the public protector is the public protector can call each and every person without the rank in terms of the investigation and just demand outputs and demand why things are not moving. So that I have observed it, and I think I'm not the only one. Those investigators can say they have observed it. So that is what happened, and that is what brought everybody closer to the public protector. And I think to the extent that she knew which investigator is dealing with which matter at any given point. Thanks.
So the way we understand the structure, investigators reported to their executive manager, which you confirm was the case in paragraph 24. But you also say in paragraph 24 that investigators reported to the PP directly as well. So when did they report to the PP directly as opposed to their executive managers?
During, thanks, Advocate, Honorable Members, and through you, Chair. During the meetings that the Public Protector would be chairing in terms of checking how far the investigations are, those respective investigators will directly account in terms of the work that they were doing. That is basically what I wanted to mean in this paragraph. So they would not go through the ranks until the EM, but the reports that would have been produced would still have to go through their senior investigators, their executive managers, the COO, and back to the PP. But in terms of checking how far is this type of investigation, PP would also go and request that information from the investigators themselves. That is what I wanted to say. That is in terms of accounting for the type, for the work and the update, they would do that. Although the production of the information would still go through all of those EMs. That is what I was trying to capture in this paragraph.
So the Frieda matter is one of the matters that form part of the motion that this committee is seized with. Were you involved in the Frieda matter at all?
Thanks, Advocate, through you, Chair. The Frieda investigation, I was not really involved in the investigation because I think when I came in, the investigation, I think, could have been in the Free State. And when it came to the office, I was really not part of the investigation. But what I remember is there was an opinion, I think, that was done. Because in the Frieda project, there was this talk about the public-private partnership between the companies that were involved. And I remember an opinion that the Frieda investigation, we need to check if there was a public-private partnership in that project. And if I recall, it was Mr. Nemesis, I think, who provided the opinion. I may be wrong, but I think it was Mr. Nemesis who was the senior manager of legal services during that time. And because of my exposure and knowledge in terms of triple P's, he requested me to check the opinion in terms of the public-private partnership. And from the opinion that I saw, and from the information that I gathered from the public-private partnership unit in National Treasury. During that time, the project was not registered as a public-private partnership unit, no public-private partnership project. And as such, it did not meet the criteria of public-private partnership as espoused by Section 60, Regulation 16 of the PFMA. So that was my involvement in trying to see if the project indeed is a public-private partnership. And I said, no, it's not a public-private partnership. And I agreed with the opinion that was given. But the investigation itself, I was not involved.
So Mr. Ndo is going to give evidence in this process. And one of the things that he will talk about in relation to the Frieda project is that the PP said that the Gupta leaks must be excluded or were not part of the investigation. Do you recall you being involved in discussions at all in relation to the Gupta leaks and Frieder?
Thanks, Advocate. Through you, Chair, I don't recall the discussion about the Gupta leaks and the decisions taken around the Gupta leaks in as far as the investigation itself is concerned. That I cannot recall.
So you don't recall a discussion you may have had with Mr. Ndo, where you told him to drop the issue about the Gupta leaks?
No, I don't recall that one. My role in the task team was mostly to take those resolutions that get taken, but the issue of discussing the Gupta leaks, I don't even remember it in as far as the Frieder Dairy Farm is concerned. I know the Gupta leaks from the media that it has been expounded, but I don't have any specific reference to Gupta leaks in as far as Frieder is concerned or the meeting that I would have had with the public protector in which the leaks were discussed. No, not of my knowledge or recollection.
So in paragraph 29, you describe some more what used to happen at certain meetings, and you say in the first sentence, and I'd like you to just elaborate for us what you say in that first sentence, that you've seen the PP reprimand employees when deadlines they undertook to meet were not met. She may well have raised her voice even when work was demanded from you. Can you tell the committee a bit more about that, Mr. Tebele?
Thanks, Advocate, and through you, Chairperson and honorable members. I think in my explanation, I have touched about this one, but I will repeat, I think, for the purpose of clarity. In the meetings that I would have said where work was demanded, yes, PP would talk about the investigators ignoring their commitments in terms of what they have committed themselves to. And that is the point that she would have been emphasizing throughout in the meetings, to say, what is the use of you giving me a deadline and you go on and not meet the deadline? And I remember specifically her saying that, don't tell me what you think I need to hear about this investigation. Tell me what you are able to produce. And during those meetings, yes, you could see with a sign language that the executive authority was not happy with what is happening. And at some point, you will feel that a particular investigator is being hammered for the work that is not properly done. And in Public Protector South Africa, you have investigations that have been sitting for a long time and nothing would have moved. And that, I think, in itself did not please the executive authority in terms of the investigation not having pulled up their source, I may say. But in those meetings, yes, I was there. I would have had those because I used to be the scriber of a dashboard meeting which was chaired by the public protector in terms of demanding or looking at investigations and how far they are. So in those meetings, I would have heard the PP's voice in terms of showing frustration and maybe agitation in terms of the demands that she wanted and the outputs, and those outputs not coming. And to me, I took it that it is because of the work that is not forthcoming, maybe that is why the executive authority reacts the way that she reacted during those meetings. Thanks.
So some of the witnesses will testify that one of the ways in which their harassment and victimization manifested was during dashboard meetings, through the PP compelling them to agree to unrealistic deadlines. Did you observe this at all?
Thanks, Advocate, and through you, Chairperson. My observation is most of our meetings' deadlines were given. Either deadlines would have been given by the investigators, or deadlines could have been given by the executive authority, even if I won't be specific in terms of which matters, because we dealt with a lot of matters. But I cannot comment about the reasonableness or the unreasonableness of those deadlines, because in most cases, you find that this matter has been here for 3 years and the investigators still need more time when the matter has already passed its life and the investigator still needs more time. So I wouldn't want to comment on the reasonableness or the unreasonableness of the deadlines, because deadlines were given under certain context. That is all what I can say, because it's very difficult to say what is a reasonable deadline if a deadline would have passed before, and what is an unreasonable one. But yes, those deadlines, they were given, others were not adhered to, and not even once, maybe twice or three times. So it did happen. So I wouldn't know why maybe they felt that they were harassed by those deadlines. Maybe those particular investigators could give the evidence in terms of the context under which they felt the unreasonableness of the deadlines. Thanks, Advocate.
Thank you, Mr. Tebele. Before Advocate Mayosi continues, just assist us and yourself. Maybe you can put your phone on silent, or so that you also stop the vibrations, because there's a lot of that next to you there. We're not saying switch it off, because you will need it so that it doesn't disturb you as calls come in or messages come in. It's better when it is in silent. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. My apologies. It was on silent. Maybe it's because it was closer. I've put it away.
Thank you.
So if you turn to paragraph 37 of your affidavit, you say that all the reports that are provided are read by the PP, and if they are not in order, they are sent back to be brought up to standard and corrected. What you're saying there, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the PP will not attach her signature to a final report that she's not satisfied with, correct?
Yeah, thanks, Advocate, and through you, Chairperson. The knowledge that I have with the PP is she reads the reports, and I've seen it in many instances where reports were sent back for one way or another. But yes, she does read the reports. That is what I can attest to.
And she has the final say, is that right?
Yes, in terms of the report being finalized and issued, the executive authority has the final say.
So, If I can take it out to paragraph 44, and specifically the third sentence of that paragraph, you're still talking about the pressures around finalizing the backlog and so on. But you say in the third sentence that you don't dispute that the work demands may have been perceived to be unreasonable. However, this wasn't caused by the PP, but by circumstances in wanting to ensure that complainants' complaints were reasonably and timeously dealt with. Can you just elaborate a little more about which aspects of the demands may have been perceived to be unreasonable? What do you mean by this?
Thanks, Advocate, through you, Chairperson and honorable members. I would have talked about this in one of my explanations. The demands of the backlog, we had also to projectize the backlog. Sometimes last year, the office of the CEO was requested to assist the office of the COO to projectize backlog cases. And in that project timeline, we had the end of September as the time in which all the cases that were in the backlog data should have been finalized. And there were a lot of cases that were still there and a lot of old matters that were there. And there was a rigorous follow-up in terms of those reports, in terms of them being finalized. And during those follow-ups, and the investigators would know that there were deadlines that were given specifically to those projects. And they were specifically requested to prioritize and deal with the projects, not as business unusual, not as business usual, but as business unusual, so that the backlog can be dealt with. And after September 2021, then investigators will have the time to deal with all other matters. There were a lot of timelines that were given in respect of those projects. Each and every investigation had its own timeline, and all the people that were involved in that project, which was managed by the office of the COO, assisted by the CEO, all had timelines. So there were a lot of demands in terms of their time, in terms of the quality. That is how I think I'm reflecting on this paragraph. So the pressure was still not anything new. It was because the matters were old. It was because the complainants were complaining. It was because the executive authority felt that we are not giving the complainants a good service. And as such, the institution itself, people may not have, I don't know how to put it, may lose confidence in the institution. I think that is what the executive authority wanted to say. But in doing that, all those projects, they had their own timelines, but the main thing was their deadline, and the main thing was that they needed to be finalized by September 2021. And everything was around that one. And this also relates to deadlines, relates to the quality that needs to be produced, also relates to the interaction by those investigators with the complainants in terms of the standards that the office has to say you need to contact the complainant within a specific time, you need to do this. So those were the demands in terms of the timelines that I was trying to indicate in this paragraph 44.
Right, taking you now to the end of your affidavit, where you deal with the issue of Audi letters, which has come up somewhat in the testimony of the previous witnesses. You yourself say you received an Audi letter. You say this in paragraph 49, and you say that in paragraph 50 that when these Audi letters were issued, it was because deadlines were not met, promised reports were not delivered. So some witnesses will say that this issuing of Audi letters in the manner in which they were issued contributed to what they will describe as a culture of fear in the organization. Can you comment on this?
Thanks, Advocate, my comment would not based on what I know from those people that will be testifying, but my comment will be based on the implication of an Audi letter. Yes, as I indicated, I did receive an Audi letter. And to me, I was shocked to receive an Audi letter because it would have been the first time, I think, in my career where I received an Audi letter. So it shocked my system, but I understood the circumstances under which the Audi letter was given. In PPSA, there were Audi letters that people would talk about. And I think people said they were complaining about Audi letters. But I wouldn't know in terms of the fear that it created with them. I can talk about my own experience because an Audi letter becomes the first step in a disciplinary process. So when you get an Audi letter, at some point you start to think that my job is on the line. I may be fired because it's the beginning of a disciplinary process. So under those circumstances, I would think that yes, they could have been fearful without knowing the exact way in which they felt. But I'm talking about an Audi letter, which is a first step of a disciplinary process. Because without an Audi letter, it means you are not going to be disciplined. But once you start getting it, it means you are beginning a process where you might face a disciplinary hearing. And then you never know what will be the end of that. So under that circumstances, yes, people could be fearful about an Audi letter. But I'm not talking about those people in terms of how they have indicated in their affidavits. But that is what I know an Audi letter to be in terms of an HR process. Thanks.
So, Mr. Tebele, you stand by the contents of your affidavit, correct?
Correct.
It was drafted with the assistance of the evidence leaders after consultations with you, correct?
Correct.
And in that process, various drafts were sent to you for your final approval before you signed it before Commissioner of Oaths.
Correct.
Can I just ask, Mr. Tebele, did you know the PP before you joined the PPSA?
Yes, I've known the PP from our university days.
There's one final issue I just want to approach with you before I let you go, Mr. Tebele. Bundle F, item 69. So this relates to the testimony that Basani Baloyi, the former COO, is going to give. She will testify that on the 18th of February 2019, so soon after she started at the PPSA, she received a text from the PP that reads as follows: COO, careful of what you hear from Bona and Tebele, but you're an adult, be wise. She'll of course say she interpreted that to mean that she should not trust you. But my question to you, do you know of any reason why the PP would issue such a warning about you? Do you know what this related to?
Thanks, Advocate. Well, it's for the first time that I see the note, and throughout my working in PPSA and working with the public protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, I've never created an environment where I believe that I would have been not trusted. But I will leave it up to the public protector because I wouldn't know why she said what she said, if it's her who said what she said. I've always believed that She trusts me. And even today, I still believe that she trusts me. And not only her, but even the CEO that I'm serving under. So I see myself as a person who can be trusted in the institution.
Thank you, Mr. Tebele. Chair, I have no further questions for this witness.
Thank you, Advocate Mayosi. Mr. Tebele, just to get a clarity quickly from you before I proceed to the next point, did I hear you say it's the first time you see this note?
Yeah,
meaning yes, Mr. Tebele. Please, Advocate Mpofu, don't disturb me.
I'm sorry, Chair. I thought I was muted.
Okay.
Yes, Honorable mute, Chair, Advocate Mpofu. I'm not aware of this note that I'm seeing now.
And you've never had on your phone this message?
Unless it was sent today.
Okay.
But not before today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tebele. Thank you.
Chair, if I could clear that up.
Yes.
It was, in fact, sent to him today, earlier before the hearing.
You sent this note to him Mr. today Tebele. Before the hearing.
Correct.
Probably has not checked his phone.
We discussed it.
You discuss it with him?
Yes.
Okay.
I was warning him that that would come up so okay. that he wouldn't be surprised.
All right. Let's take it, I think, because that would happen today, because that's what he said. He did not see it before today. Am I right, Mr. Tebele? That could have been in the morning and so on.
Yes, Honorable Chair.
Okay.
It was brought to my attention today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tebele. Honorable members, the time now is just 27 minutes past 11. We're going to take a break and be back at 1:45. We pause here. Thank you.